And Giuseppe's real 12.
Yeah, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I know it was a Friday, when all of a sudden, all hell broke loose. The firing was directed into this ward that we had. There was on two floors, on the ground floor, bullets flying all over the place, all bullets whistling around myself. I went to the far end and tried to keep away, having the two sides of the cells, and of course, the firing was from my right, and of course it was hitting everything in daylight. There was an awful lot of firing. There must have been several Brens and machine guns that they were using. Lots of groans and people being hit and what have you. And then the firing stopped. And all quiet remained. The clerk, I then shouted out to the clerk. I said, look, let me say, get me out of this cell. I want to go and see what's happened, you see. I went down, and sure enough, about 8 or 9 killed, a whole lot of wounded, and I then went to the gates of the compound, shouted out for medical aid. Nobody wanted to know. It wasn't until the Sunday evening, that's 48 hours later, that eventually the medical officer, who was a Sikh, eventually came, and I said, where the hell were you? He said, well, those are my orders. I wasn't to do anything. He brought medical assistance or what have you, removed the dead. We tried very hard trying to tear sheets and all the rest of it to bandage these people. That was the end of that. But 4 days after that, the judicial minister, who was the son of John McNeill, his father was an Irish judge. John was Anglo-Burmese. He comes to the prison. And he comes to this particular ward to see, you know, what had actually happened and where they did the firing. Huh? And he sees me there, and he's horrified to find me there. What are you doing here, Clara? I said, what do you mean, what am I doing here, my dear friend? You were behind my arrest. He said, I know nothing about your arrest. I said, you're a fine judicial minister then. He said, I'm the top end there, my dear boy. And he said, I don't get mundane things. I said, what do you mean by saying my arrest is mundane? My God, he said, you shouldn't be here. I apologized profusely. Right, we're going to shift you. Where? He said, into Dr. Barbour's bungalow. Now, when Dr. Barbour, who was the Prime Minister of Burma before the war, was involved in... He was the lawyer that defended all those people who rebelled in 1930. He was always known as a troublemaker. He spent long terms of prison in Rangoon Jail. And to make life comfortable for him, they built him an actual bungalow with bedrooms and a lot. He said, I'm going to transfer you to Dr. Barber's bungalow. Your two companions will be the ex-Karad Prime Minister, some source of both it, and the leader of the Karad National Organization, Tarab Faith II. And I said, oh, well, thanks very much. So I moved out. And I had a wonderful time. Servants, we had Sikh doctor came to me and he said, you've got low blood pressure. I said, have I? How do you know? And he said, well, that's all right. You get a tot of brandy a day. And he said, don't take the brandy every day. He said, at the end of the week, you'll get a bottle of brandy and you can enjoy yourself. So I spent up to, it was April, May, June, July. And I spent 5 months in Rangoon Jail. Then I was asked to go up to Akyab because proceedings were to take place in the lower court there, because that was the appropriate court for these offences that I had alleged to have committed in the Akyab. So I go on my own steam. No escort, no nothing. I get to Akyab. I'm then taken before a magistrate who's a bit nervous, and he says, well, I'm afraid I've got to remand you in prison custody. By which time, I was quite happy to be, well, if I was going to be there, I was quite happy to go into prison. Didn't want to be obliged to anybody. There was nobody I could stay with. I had to be very careful that that didn't have a good mix of people who might have been involved with me. I think my friends were very open.
I must say, my Burmese friends,
they said they didn't give a damn, I mean, as far as they're concerned. But they didn't want to be a burden on them, and involved with they might have been arrested. So when he said, you're remanded in prison custody, have you got bail that you can produce? I said, I'm not interested in bail. But he set bail at 15,000 rupees or something, and two sureties. I said, no, I'm not worried. I stayed for the couple of days with some friends of mine. He was the shipping agent for McKinley McKenzie, George Hancock and his wife Connie. They had a bungalow along the beach. And so that afternoon, got into a car, and Connie had a lot of blankets and whatever. She was so distressed. I said, don't worry, I'm quite used to prison. She said, oh, that Akyab jail must be terrible. I said, no, don't worry. Anyway, I get to the prison, offloaded. She makes sure that I've got a handful of food. That evening, the district and sessions judge, who was an Aragonese, comes out to the prison and he said, that bloody magistrate needs his head examined. He said, fancy remanding you in custody. He said, I've stood surety for you, and Hancock here is the other surety. Come on, out. I said, well, who the hell am I going to stay with, for God's sake? And John said, you've got to stay with us. I said, well, I'll be a nuisance, really. I'm quite happy here. When I was in Rangoon jail, I took over the library. I gave myself something to do. I read all the books and things like that. So I stayed with them till I was tried in March. I went down to Rangoon after Christmas, 51. The trial took place in January, February, 1951. I was charged with receiving the proceeds of smuggling rice. This business of murdering 30 Muslim women disappeared. I beg your pardon. Yeah, it was still on the charge sheet. I was also accused of disposing of government property. Now, when I used to tour the Arakan, I had a double-decker launch. It was luxurious. I had 300 miles of river, the Caledon River. I used to go right up, and I had to visit different stations and what have you. And I found that there were certain places you could only get through by going up through mangrove streams. And to be rowed in a canoe took about 6 or 7 hours to get up to these villages. I used to go to the villages. I found that the army had left quite a few of these, they call them hydroplanes, you know, little boats. And we had in the police stores a whole lot of outboard 22 horsepower outboard engines. So I got one of these boats. In fact, it didn't belong to the government, it belonged to George Hancock. He had a few of them. So I bought one of these hydroplanes off him for a couple of £100. The engines that we had on charge, they were not on charge either, they were just stuck in the store there. I cannibalized one or two engines and got one working engine. And I used that for official. See, I used to be on my launch, and then if I wanted to go to a village, I hopped in. I got a policeman who was a driver, and we'd zoom up through the water, get to this place, come back in reasonable time, you see. So when I was leaving, the headman from Bouvidal, he said he saw my boat and he said he wanted to buy it. And I said, okay, fine. I said, well, I bought it from Mr. Hancock for 200 rupees. You can have it for 200 rupees with the engine. The engine wasn't on charge. It was the engine I used. And all others were falling to pieces. Okay. I disposed of government property. The engine. And the engine was produced or a engine was produced as evidence. I looked at it and I said, I don't recognize this engine at all. This is not the one I did, because my driver and I cannibalized the thing and we put it together, and it was paint that had gone. That was a Johnson 22, and this is an Evinrude 22 horsepower. And I said, somebody, and it was in a beautiful box. You know, they did there. There was a stupid thing. They had this box, a pucker box that was built for this engine. So I said to the caller, I said, I don't recognize this engine at all. Anyway, the three that were on the tribunal, Justice Chumbiu was a senior judge. Justice Mang Mao, who I knew from my police service in Tongu, he was the other judge, and the third one I didn't know very well. Well, I was, when I got to Rangoon, I was granted bail. And I stayed with the financial commissioner, who, like me, was a very keen Freemason. And we used to attend lodge. I attended two lodges, a Scottish lodge and my own lodge. And Justice Tumbiu was a member of my lodge. And we often used to talk, and he'd say, don't worry, that is the way. He said, we've got to go through the motions. He said, they're in a bit of a corner now. They've got to justify a trial. They've had you here for so long. And when the trial came, I was acquitted of all charges. But fined 50 rupees for having disposed of this, even though I said that this is not the airport. So I've got the government of Burma orders acquitting me of all the major charges, compensation, back pay to be paid, and honorably discharged from all accounts and whatever. And in March 1951, I left Burma. At that particular time, I get to Kendo, the Prime Minister, saying, will you reconsider staying in Burma for another time? I said, you must be joking. At the trial, I remember Justice Tumbiu saying, is it your intention to stay in Burma? I said, that's the most ridiculous suggestion ever made to me. I said, stay in this country where my grandfather's given his services, my father's given his services, I've given my services, well known to members of this court and the general public in Burma. The risks I've taken for the sake of serving this government, and you expect me, having done all that, to be rewarded with being arrested and incarcerated for a whole year, separated from my family for a whole year. You expect me to say that I want to stay in this country? I said, no, thank you very much. And the press took it up. And I remember my lawyer was a very said, well, look, there might be another bloody charge the way I said, they can. I said, you can keep this country. I said, I'll never return to this country. I said, I'll never return to this country. You people don't know what gratitude is. All that you're worried about is having your own back against people. You got the impression that I had taken over the Arakan. Yes, I took over the Arakan for the sake of the Burma government. Nobody else. You see, I think I mentioned earlier on, my great-grandmother was this Thai lady who had married this Burmese minister. When I took over the Arakan, they always had, this is all that I learned when I came home. The ambassador to the Burmese ambassador, a chap called Anso, in fact, I was interested in that article in the Telegraph. Who this Anso is? George Anso. He was one of the early Burmans who joined the Indian Civil Service. Now, he was the ambassador, and I knew George and his wife very well, Jessie, Bessie. And I said, George, do you know why I was arrested? I said, all this rubbish about smuggling rice. I said, I've got to, in that thing I'll show you, receipts of the money that I recovered for the Burma government from the treasury that had been taken over by the insurgents. The incidents of the number of times I arrested these big sailing boats taking rice across, all that's on record. I said, I don't believe for a minute that was there. I don't believe for a minute. Oh yes, they got this Burma Rifles officer who was with me at the time when I shot Chukwu dead. He was in charge of two sections. he was going to be a very brave officer, but once we got direction, he realized that I was such an experienced fellow. I was very much his boss. He was saluting me every now and again because I extricated him out of a situation like that. He was brought to give evidence to say that he saw me murder, rape and murder these people. He came and said, "That's a total lie." He said, "I was aboard his launch. He never went ashore. He got the Burma Navy to shell this place because they ambushed at the mouth of this river." And of course, that was dropped. He said, "I have a great regard for this officer. He is a very brave officer. He extricated us from a situation where things looked a little bit hopeless. But for his courage, we would have never have got out." Okay. And he said in court, "I salute this officer." Never called me the accused or anything like that. So that went from there. So when I said to George, "Did you ever find out, you left Burma long after I did, you were in sort of circles," and he said, "Tell me what they were very suspicious about." He said, "You know, during the assassination, there was all this involvement of the British and what have you. Then you suddenly turn up in the Arakan, become the boss of the Arakan. Then they look in your family records, or they know that your great-grandmother was Thai. She was in the Burmese royal family household. You were going to take over Burma and proclaim yourself as king of Burma." I said, "George, how ridiculous." He said, "Well, that was the meaning." He said, "You know these people." He said, "I heard this mentioned as the Turk girl several times." And he said, "Well, that'd be ridiculous." He said, "Well, you never know. That chap's a very forceful fellow. He didn't give a damn for anybody in the government." And he said, "Well, he was forthright and honest. He gave you his honest opinion. He wasn't going to mince words. He never mentioned anything about what went on outside the conference room. But he said if he had something to say, he was speaking the truth." I mean, I warned the Burmese government, the Prime Minister. I said, "Don't trust the Arakanese." And here's the Arakanese minister sitting here. He said, "They don't want you in the Arakan. For two pins, they'll join the communists, the terrorists." I said, "In fact, none of these people are worried about the terrorists being on the other bank of the island of Akyan. Because they're damn well, if they did take over, nothing would happen." I said, "It's a sort of an unspoken harboring of people. I was the only one who was worried." I said, "I was worried for the European community and the Anglo-Burmese community. If these fellows took over Akyan town, they would have slaughtered all these people. And for that reason, I formed a special army, special force of these chins who were up in the mountains. I brought them down. They were like savages. They dressed in loincloths and what have you. Put a bread in their hand, they'd strip it, put it back. They're all Force 136 people. They knew exactly what to do." And I said, "That was, I couldn't rely on the Arakanese military police. They were deserting, you see, left, right, and center. They took over Chalkyu, this poor man, Noel Longji. He was ousted from the place. I retook that island for the government. And there's records here from the Commonwealth Relations Office, I'm sure you want to see it, to say of the different actions that I took. And then when they decided to change that Burmese police silver medal for the colonial police battle, Eric Battersby, who was then the governor's secretary, was a Burma police officer, I have a letter from him where it said replaced by so and so. But I was a little bit dissatisfied with the medal that I got. It was for meritorious service. It should have been colonial police battle for gallantry, where you wear it, takes precedence over everything else." Is it? Still, I had it in the box for years.
If you could just go over how you discovered the body of Aung San again, please.
Yes. At about 11 o'clock on the 19th of July, when I was sitting in my office with the secretary and I was discussing the case with this Indian inspector, we heard a rattling. And I said to him immediately, "That sounds like machine gun fire." And he said, "No, sir. No, sir. It's the either the anchor chains being let down or taken up, or the ships in the harbour. The Rangoon Quay was about 400 yards from the Secretary's building. So I sort of said, oh, well, yes. All of a sudden, there were a lot of people running about. We were on the ground floor, and although there were brick floors above me, I could hear this thundering around. And then the next thing was Kenneth Unshing, the Commissioner of Police of Rangoon, came past my office and said, Carlisle, quick, 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 council chamber, have you got a weapon on you? And I said, yes, I had a firearm pistol. He said, follow me. And I told him, what I said, follow me as well. And we went up. I quite frankly didn't know where the council chamber was. But we went up the steps and got to the first floor and rushed off. And then we could see a body on the floor, a lot of blood. And there was this dead chap there. He was half Burmese, Zerbadi. And the next thing, we went into this council chamber. And as I say, the whole of the place was like a thick fog. It had hung for all that time. Well, I suppose it was, 15, 20 minutes after these fellows had fired and shoved off. And then, as we got used to the smoke, we could see Aung San's body slumped over the table. It was a long table, and all these people had been sitting on either side, slumped over, and his face was like this, and of course you could see it was Aung San. And there were a whole lot of holes in his back there. Bullets had gone right through. They shot him at point-blank range. I think what happened was he turned. When Kim Aung Ying, this chap who became King's evidence, said, I asked him, he said, well, when they came back, as we went in, he turned towards us, and we opened fire. They let him have it at that about 5 foot range, you see. And some of the bullets must have gone right through his body. And of course, he always wore a khaki tunic, dressed himself like a general. All the cloth had been sort of. And then we saw these others that were burning away. And then next thing I heard was a voice from right to far corner, Carlisle, is that you? And this was Henry Tunnard, the bodyguard, Captain Tunnard. I said, what are you doing there? He said, I was hiding under the table. I said, you're a fine bodyguard. And he came. And he said, oh, my God, bonjour, going through the old palaver of the great grief. And I said to myself, yeah, I'll have a fine bodyguard. But then you can't blame him for putting his chest there. And there were six killed. There were six dead, I know. But I left because I had to get down as quickly as possible to get in touch with Tunlar, and Kenneth Unshing took over after that. And at one comment he made to me, he said, well, what do you think of him? And I said, well, he lived by the sword, he dies by the sword.